Well, it's Eamon, your non-binary host, and this is the 52nd episode of The Art of Asymmetrical Warfare. Today, I'll provide a recap on the Anglo-Irish Treaty. First, sorry, we have to get the begging for money bit out of the way. As you all know, I love researching, I love writing scripts, I love recording episodes, I love doing my TikTok videos, but it's hard to do without finances. Even when I'm borrowing materials from the library, I still need to pay for things like web hosting costs, subscription costs, food, travel, things like that. If you enjoyed my last two seasons and are excited about season three, then please join my Patreon. I've done a couple of behind-the-scenes videos for my Patreon. You get exclusive access to exclusive content. You'll get early access to recordings like this. And it would just be really helpful. It just really helped me continue to do the work that I've been doing if you join. And so now that that part is over, it's time for making history. So in case you didn't know, last week, the Supreme Court voted that you can discriminate against LGBTQ people, voted that Biden doesn't have the right to end student debt, and voted to end a part of affirmative action, which would require universities and colleges to be race conscious when they are accepting applicants. Except if you're a military college. If you're a military college, you can get all the people of color that you want. But if university or college, it's non-military, you don't have to be race conscious anymore. You can just accept a bunch of white people and nobody cares. These are really heavy rulings. I have not felt this way since they voted down Roe v. Wade. People are going to tell you to vote. Vote if you feel that's what's right. People are going to tell you to call your representatives. Call them if you feel that's what's right. I mean, at the very least, you can let your frustration out on them because, particularly our Democrats, they're not doing anything. But what we're seeing is a slow return to segregation. Because if colleges don't have to worry about accepting non-white students, they're not going to. And the Supreme Court just needs a made-up case, and then they can start attacking employment, and they can start attacking housing. Combine that with their fight to prevent Biden from forgiving just $20K for some. I think it's like, what, he's not even forgiving all of it. He's just forgiving some of it. I think the most he's going to be forgiving is $20K. Like, that's going to hurt a lot of people, and they put them more at the mercy of the state and the police and the military, and that's their goal. So it's a very scary, scary time. On top of that, you know, you have the trans genocide going on as well, which they've now made easier because some woman created a hypothetical of, like, what if I was a website designer, and what if someone who was gay asked me to design a website? What then, Supreme Court? And Supreme Court said, well, then you don't have to do it. So it wasn't even a real case. She just made up a story, and they were like, oh, yeah, we'll use this to allow you to discriminate against people. So it's really scary right now. And I don't have faith in our institutions. So, like I said, if you want to vote, vote. Like, I do believe in, you know, dual strategies. I do believe that, you know, voting is still important because we still need some people in Congress and the White House. But if they're not going to do anything, like, they're not doing anything right now, they're not going to save us. So vote if you feel it's right. Campaign if you feel it's right. Call your reps if you feel it's right. I'm not going to dissuade you from that. But we have to do more. And so I looked at online, I looked at, like, Movement for Black Lives, Black Lives Matters, Good Kids, Mad City. I'm not seeing a concrete ask around affirmative action yet. I did see on Twitter a suggestion of donating to your local HBCU schools, historically Black colleges and universities. And Black Lives Matter has a great page, which I'll provide a link to, about a student solidarity fund that they've organized to help students go to HBCU schools. And if you just Google the one closest to you, you can find out their donation information. So donating to them because HBCU schools are great places for Black people specifically to get an education. A lot of famous historical Black people have gotten their education from these schools, and if white schools are going to just not accept Black people, then these schools are going to need the funding, because that'll be the next thing Congress cuts is funding for these schools and special status for these schools. Because right now they have special status because they were historically Black colleges that were created before 1964. So there's a whole thing there. You can look it up to learn more of the history. But so that was one ask that I saw that is doable. I think another ask, and this is just coming from me, so if I see feedback, you know, I'll let you guys know. But I think another thing we can do is that we can call our schools, especially if we are alumni who donate money. Because I'm an alumni, I don't donate any money though, so I'm not sure they're going to listen to me. But even if you don't, still call your schools. But if we're in a position of power within our colleges and universities, we need to call our colleges and universities and say, okay, I don't care what the Supreme Court said, I still expect to see the same amount of students that we've accepted in the past, or an increased amount of people of color and Black students and Indigenous students. And, you know, threaten to withhold your donations. If you are in a position where your kid would go to university via legacy admission, tell the school that, no, I'm not going to do that unless you give the same amount of opportunities to people of color and to Black people and to Indigenous people. I think that's one thing that we can do as people, specifically white people, with money and influence. We can call our schools and just be like, I don't care. This Supreme Court is not legitimate, and I don't want to live in a world where my kid or the university that I support becomes a bastion of white supremacy, more so than it already is, right? So that's one thing we can definitely do for sure. Yeah, like I said, the other thing is to donate to your HBCU school. And then the final thing we can do is start reaching out to people in your community, whether it be your apartment building or just the floor of your apartment or your street, like your neighbors. Just like invite people over, get together, and just see where people are at. You know, just offer food, see if anyone needs help with anything. Just kind of start creating that collective. Because once you start creating that collective, you can take care of each other in ways that the government can't. And that's where organizing power comes from. In terms of the LGBTQ ruling, I mean, just find a local LGBTQ organization and donate to them. Find your local LGBTQ friends and family members and call them and just see how they're doing. And then the third thing we can do, again, as people with power and influence, start reporting the shops that are discriminating against people. Like, just start leaving Yelp reviews, call them out on Facebook, call them out on Twitter, if Twitter still exists in the next few days. Call them out on Instagram, call them out on TikTok. Just, like, shame them for what they're doing, because the Supreme Court's not going to do it. Democrats aren't going to do it. It's up to us. And then finally, with the student debt relief, there is an organization called the Debt Collective, and they have a lot of resources. I was looking at their website, which I'll provide a link to in the description. They have a bunch of workshops, including how to organize a debt strike. They are trying to create a debtors union, basically. So for like a small donation of $5, you can join their union and get tapped in with like a local chapter, and then you can work together to figure out how we're going to convince Biden to forgive all the student debt to begin with, and then move on to other types of debt. They do have a movement, the student debt strike, which is basically you're just not going to pay what you owe. And they have a lot of information of like how you can do that. You know, how do you cover your assets if you do that? How do you survive when they start calling you and threatening to take your money anyway? So they're trying to really build a network to help you fight debt, basically, as well as pressure Biden to forgive the debt, which he can still do because the Supreme Court ruling applied to one law, but there's a different law, which is the Debt Collective has a video on. That Biden can still use to forgive student debt. And again, in this situation, if you want to call your rep, call them, because they need to know that this is really going to affect them in the 2024 election, because that's the only time they'll do anything. But like, we don't need promises, we need actual action. But I think we'll have more chance of changing things if we join the Debt Collective and work together to ensure that, you know, It's not one person's not paying their debt and being penalized. It's a whole community of people who are supporting each other and helping each other and just proving that this debt is unmanageable for a single individual. So if you're feeling sad, if you're feeling defeated, those are 100% reasonable reactions. I mean, I'll admit this triggered a depressive spell for me, and it's really freaking scary. But the only way we're going to survive is if we help each other. And the only way we help each other is if we actually take a step out of our door and say hi to our neighbors. That's like really step one, is getting to know who's near us and what needs they have and what needs you have, and starting creating this network of people that you can rely on. And then joining the debt collective and looking at Black-led organizations as well as queer-led organizations in terms of fighting the affirmative action ruling and the discrimination ruling. So feel sad, feel angry, feel even hopeless, but don't sit with those feelings too long, and know that there are people out there who are going to fight, who are fighting, and who need our help. There's always hope, even now, even when things seem so bad. And now, sort of an awkward segue, but now we're going to talk about the Anglo-Irish tree. One cannot understand the Irish Civil War without first understanding the Anglo-Irish Treaty. That's why I wanted to provide this recap. This episode is for people who listened to my first season but wanted a quick refresher, and for people who haven't had a chance to listen to my first season and want a quick summary of the conflict. Part 1. Truce. A truce between Britain and the IRA was declared on July 11, 1921. According to the truce, the British agreed to 1. Stop the raids and searches, 2. Restrict military activity to support police during their normal duties, 3. Remove the curfew restrictions, 4. Suspend reinforcements from England, 5. Replace the IRC with the Dublin Metropolitan Police. In turn, the IRA agreed to 1. Avoid provocative displays, 2. Prohibit the use of arms, 3. Cease military maneuvers. The IRA released a bulletin announcing the truce, which added additional terms. The British also agreed to 1. No incoming troops or munitions, 2. No military movements, 3. No pursuit of Irish officers or men or war material, 4. No secret agents spying on the IRA, and then 5. No pursuit of lines of communication. In addition, the IRA agreed to 1. No attacks on Crown forces and civilians, 2. No provocative displays of forces, 3. No interference with government or private property, 4. No disturbing of the peace. Neither side was happy with the truce. The British claimed that waving the Sinn Féin flag was provocative and that they had to exert all discipline while the Irish didn't have to. GHQ complained that according to the treaty, the military couldn't move freely in Ireland. After several disagreements, the British backed down and recalled its forces into their barracks. Meanwhile, the IRA believed this was a temporary truce and continued to recruit, drill, and prepare for the resumption of war. For De Valera, the preliminary negotiations were a chance to reassert himself as the leader of the Dáil and Irish liberation. Part 2. Preliminary Negotiations. De Valera and an Irish delegation, which comprised of Arthur Griffith, Austin Stack, Robert Barton, Count Plunkett, and Erskine Childers, traveled to London on July 12th to begin preliminary discussions with Lloyd George. De Valera would meet with Lloyd George 4 times between July 14th and the 21st. Lloyd George's proposal was to turn Ireland into a dominion, but they would have no navy, no hostile tariffs, and no coercion of Ulster. De Valera refused, saying that, quote, dominion status for Ireland would never be real. Ireland's proximity to Britain would not allow it to develop as dominions thousands of miles away could. Even though De Valera rejected his proposal, Lloyd George continued to honor the truce, and De Valera returned to Dublin. De Valera had a proposal of his own, known as Document 2, or External Associations, a point of controversy. This document proposed that Ireland would not be a dominion, but it would still have associations with England. When he explained it to Erskine Childers and Robert Brennan, he drew 5 circles inside a large circle. The large circle was England, and the other circles were the dominions it currently ruled. He then drew a circle outside of the big circle, but connecting to it, and that was supposed to be Ireland. Unfortunately, he was either never able to properly explain his plan to his fellow Irishmen, or the British cabinet, or it was simply too much for people. Many of the diehard Republicans found it baffling or betrayal, and the British couldn't see how it was different from having an alliance with an independent state, and thus unacceptable. De Valera formally shared this document with his cabinet on July 27th, but refused to share it with Lloyd George, fearing it would be too revealing if sent to the British in its current form. De Valera seemed to want to see how far they could push the British before offering his external association as a compromise. He sent a formal reply to Lloyd George, rejecting Dominion status, with a vague description of his external association plan. The British and Irish agreed to continue negotiations. A new team was to be created to represent Ireland, a team De Valera refused to be a member of. Part 2A, the Irish delegation. The Irish cabinet met once more on September 9th to discuss who would go negotiate on Ireland's behalf. This is maybe one of the most controversial moments in a rather controversial process and war. When the cabinet met that day, they were met by De Valera's bombshell that he would not lead the Irish delegation. Additionally, he required that all British offers would be reviewed by the Dáil before the delegation made any agreements. The second point of controversy was whether the goal of the negotiation was to walk away with a republic or if it was to walk away with any level of independence from Britain. Lloyd George had already made it clear that Britain would never accept a republic or full Irish independence. But where did the Irish stand? For the entirety of the war, De Valera's title had been President of the Dáil Éireann and was changed to President of the Irish Republic on August 26th. Was that a signal that the republic was the goal or formality? Members like Braga and Mary McSweeney were under the impression that either the British promised to recognize an Irish republic or it was back to war. Yet Michael Collins went on record saying that, quote, the declaration of a republic by the leaders of the Rising was far in advance of national thought. And McSweeney accosted Harry Bolin and his and De Valera's perceived lack of commitment to a republic and warned him to, quote, please leave your dual monarchy nonsense behind you. Our oaths are to the republic or nothing less. And both of these quotes are from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. De Valera didn't help at all by refusing to provide any sort of guidance to the delegation, and it seems that if De Valera truly believed the republic or the external association idea was ideal for Ireland, he never told the members of the delegation. Finally, to make matters worse, De Valera was sending the delegation as plenipotentiaries, who technically should have full powers to handle negotiations, but De Valera crippled their powers by requiring that they refer back to the cabinet for major questions and with the, quote, the complete text of the draft treaty about to be signed. However, the British assumed they were normal plenipotentiaries and could not, as Viceroy Lord Fitzalan told Lloyd George, quote, take advantage of De Valera's absence to delay and refer back to him. The cabinet protested De Valera's proposal strenuously, but De Valera persisted, and despite all this ambiguity and disbelief that De Valera would not go to London, the cabinet approved the following appointments. Arthur Griffith, Michael Collins, Robert Barton, Eamon Duggan, George Gavin Duffy, Erskine Childers, Fionnan Lynch, Dermond O'Hagerty, and John Chartres. De Valera dismissed Duggan and Duffy as mere legal padding, but hoped that Barton would be stubborn enough to limit the amount of compromises the Irish would have to make, and trusted Childers to serve as a source of strength for Barton. De Valera seems to have ignored the fact that Griffith despised Childers. Their instructions were to negotiate and conclude a treaty of settlement, association, and accommodation between Ireland and the community of nations known as the British Commonwealth. Part 3. Treaty Negotiations. The Irish delegation arrived in London on October 8th. And took residence at 22 Hans Place and 15 Cadogan Gardens in Kensington. The first meeting of the negotiations took place on October 11th at 10 Downing Street. The Irish were facing the lights of David Lloyd George, Winston Churchill, Lord Birkenhead, Austen Chamberlain, Sir Laming Worthington Evans, Sir Gordon Hewart, and Sir Homer Greenwood. It cannot be denied that the British were more experienced and were better prepared than the Irish. They also had the benefit of being in agreement that a republic was out of the question, and the goal was to get the Irish to agree to a dominion status. They had a document all written out outlining their proposal, whereas the Irish had De Valera's vague association vague external association document and his unconnected thoughts about Ulster's future. Yet despite their formidable reputation and skills, all was not cozy in the British delegation. For one thing, it was missing a very important player in British politics at the time, Bonar Law, the man who nearly pushed the Conservatives to civil war during the 1912 crisis, and the man who would lead the Tory revolt against the very treaty that ended Lloyd George's career. Lloyd George also had the external pressure from Ulster not to give an inch when it came to the Ulster exception. The delegation would meet 7 times between October 11th and 24th, while also breaking out into 3 different committees, the Committee on Naval and Air Defense, the Committee on Financial Relations, and the Committee on the Observation of the Truce, which consisted of members from both delegations. These committees would meet between October 12th to November 10th. After October 24th, the negotiations would be conducted through sub-conferences, which met 24 times in various locations until the signing of the treaty on December 6th. Because of the complex nature of the Irish-British relationship, a lot of time would be spent trying to figure out Irish financial autonomy. However, the 2 points that caused the most trouble between the negotiating parties was Ireland's unity and allegiance to the crown. In regard to Ulster, Lloyd George had already promised the Unionists that Ulster would not be coerced, and effectively recognized partition as the only solution. Lloyd George proposed creating an Ulster Parliament and a boundary commission to determine the borders of the new states. Collins and Griffith hated the compromise because it was partition, but Lloyd George warned them that if they didn't agree, he would be forced to resign and they'd be facing Bonar Law, a British politician even more opposed to Irish interests than Lloyd George. They grudgingly agreed. The nature of Ireland's relations to the crown was a thornier problem since the Irish wanted complete legal sovereignty and the British demanded an oath of loyalty. For the British, the oath represented a desperate symbol of control as they lost a part of their empire. For the Irish, the oath was a literal vow of subjugation. Griffith and Collins were quick to understand that symbols meant nothing if Ireland to be guaranteed real power over her own destiny. Collins believed that the treaty was a stepping stone to further independence for Ireland. Put another way, what power would Britain truly have over Ireland if Ireland had an Irish government, Irish police force, Irish army, and Irish courts? The negotiations dragged on Lloyd George to the brink of despair. The British delegation split the Irish delegation in half and worked mostly with Griffith and Collins, creating great disgruntlement in the Irish camp. This would spell disaster for Collins and Griffith when they returned to Ireland. Fed up, Lloyd George sent the Irish an ultimatum. Either they signed the treaty now or refused to sign and resume the war. The Irish delegation was badly split. Griffith, Collins, and Duggan were in favor of the treaty, while Barton and Gavin Duffy were against the treaty. Lloyd George put pressure on the Irish delegation, claiming that he was preparing to tell Craig, his cabinet, and Parliament that the negotiations had broken down. For their part, the Irish delegation was in constant communication with De Valera, insisting he come to London now and help them, but he refused. Lloyd George first got Griffith to agree to the treaty, which then forced the other Irish delegates to follow suit. The Irish delegation returned to 10 Downing Street and signed the treaty at 2:10 a.m. on December 6th. What exactly did they sign? In the end, the treaty promised nothing that wasn't part of the proposal prepared in July. Its main clauses were as follows. Crown forces would withdraw from most of Ireland, except for like 3 seaports. Ireland was to become a self-governing dominion of the British Empire, a status shared by Australia, Canada, Newfoundland, New Zealand, and the Union of South Africa. As with the other dominions, the King would be the head of state of the Irish Free State and would be represented by a Governor General. Members of the new Free State's Parliament would be required to take an oath of allegiance to the Irish Free State. A secondary part of the oath was to, quote, be faithful to His Majesty King George V, his heirs and successors by law in virtue of the common citizenship. Northern Ireland, which had already been created by the Government of Ireland Act, would have the option of withdrawing from the Irish Free State within 1 month of the treaty coming into effect. If Northern Ireland chose to withdraw, a boundary commission would be constituted to draw the boundary between the Irish Free State and Northern Ireland. Britain, for its own security, would continue to control a limited number of ports, known as the treaty ports, for the Royal Navy. The Irish Free State would assume responsibility for a proportionate part of the United Kingdom's debt, as it stood on the date of signature. The treaty would have superior status in Irish law, i.e. in the event of a conflict between it and the new 1922 Constitution of the Irish Free State, the treaty would take precedence. Part 4, Irish Reaction. While the treaty was celebrated in England, and Lloyd George considered it a massive victory, the reaction in Ireland was quite different. De Valera refused to read the treaty, and when it was published in the newspaper, he was furious it had been published without his review or approval. He publicly announced that he could not, quote, recommend the acceptance of this treaty. Many IRA soldiers were confused and upset over the treaty's terms, especially the oath of loyalty to the king. They couldn't believe Collins would agree to this kind of treaty. De Valera planned to request the resignation of the three plenipotentiary members who were also in the cabinet, Collins, Griffith, and Barton, but William Cosgrave convinced him to hear them out first. Most of the military high command were in favor of ratifying the treaty, providing their reasoning during the private Dáil debates on December 17th and 20th. Sean McGowan reported that he had 500 volunteers and enough ammunition for 7 minutes of fighting and that the British would wipe them out. Éowyn O'Duffy agreed, and Sean Hales, McGowan, and O'Duffy pointed out that the intelligence situation had drastically changed as well. During the second meeting, all the officers who made up GHQ and were members of the Dáil, and several who held commands in the country, agreed that resuming the war would only end in disaster for the IRA. Mulcahy sent out one of his many memos insisting that the army should stay out of politics, and since it was an instrument of the state, it should have no opinion on public affairs. However, there were emergencies in which the state must consult with the army heads, and there were questions the army were entitled to answer. He did not believe the IRA could win militarily if the treaty was resumed. Griffith and Collins were under no illusions of what waited for them in London. Collins even wrote on the day he signed the treaty, quote, "When you have sweated, toiled, had mad dreams, hopeless nightmares, you find yourself in London streets, cold and dank in the night air. Think, what have I got for Ireland? Something which she has wanted these past 700 years. Will anyone be satisfied at the bargain? Will anyone? I tell you this, early this morning I signed my death warrant. I thought at the time how old, how ridiculous. A bullet may just as well have done the job 5 years ago." End quote is from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. On December 8th, the cabinet met with Collins, Barton, Griffith, and Cosgrave, stating they would recommend approval of the treaty to the Dáil. De Valera, Broda, and Stats opposed them. They decided that the president would issue a press statement defining the position of the minority and that the Dáil would hold public sessions on December 14th. During his statement, De Valera made it clear that he was opposed to the treaty, stating, "starting the Dáil debates on an even rockier foot and making himself the lightning rod for everyone who wanted to reject the treaty." The public debates broke down to two camps, the treatyites and the anti-treatyites. Those who supported the treaty argued that the IRA had done all it could militarily do, and to continue the war would be a disaster. They argued that the goal was never to drive the British to the sea, but to break down the prestige which the enemy derived from his unquestionable superior force. To believe otherwise was fantasy. Collins offered his stepping stone argument, and Hales argued that this was a jumping off point, and in a year or 10, Ireland will have freedom. Collins even told Hales in a private conversation that, quote, "the British broke the Treaty of Limerick, which ended the Jacobite War in 1691, and we'll break this treaty too when it suits us, when we have our own army." The anti-treatyites refused or were unable to see Collins' logic that this was the best they could do for now. Many did not want to accept partition, remain a part of the British Empire, and especially despised the oath. And there were those in the middle, who looked to their comrades for an explanation or opinion on what to do. The problem for the anti-treatyites is that they didn't have an alternative to offer. De Valera tried to introduce his external association idea, but it died in the water, and while the treatyites were full of principle, they had little else. For the treatyites, it was all about accepting this limited victory in order to achieve a bigger one. As Collins put it, this treaty didn't give the ultimate freedom, but, quote, "the freedom to achieve that end." And Mulcahy would say it provided a, quote, "solid spot of ground on which the Irish people can put its political feet." The Dáil recessed during Christmas, and during this time, public opinion, the press, and the church swung towards accepting the treaty. While the anti-treatyites would ignore or dismiss how the people felt, the treatyites used it to support their cause. As Christmas passed, the first Christmas, Ireland had not been at war one way or another since 1914, the Dáil reconvened and the attacks became increasingly personal, with the Freeman's Journal denouncing De Valera as lacking the, quote, instinct of an Irishman in his blood, and De Valera accused Griffith of crookedness, and Broda claimed that Collins was a hack who deliberately sought notoriety and had been built up as a heroic figure, which he was not. On December 7th, the final vote was taken, and the Dáil approved the treaty by 64 to 57. De Valera resigned as president of the Dáil Éireann on January 9th and stood for re-election. On January 10th, De Valera was defeated in the vote for the Dáil presidency by 60 to 58 votes. He and all anti-treaty deputies walked out, quote, as a protest against the election as president of the Irish Republic of the chairman of the delegation who is bound by treaty conditions to set up a state which is to subvert the republic. Griffith was elected president of Dáil Éireann. The Dáil was adjourned until February 11th. On January 14th, the provisional government was established with Collins as chairman. The stage was set for civil war. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy this episode. You can listen to my full catalog on Spotify, iTunes, and my website, www.samswarroom.com. Please join my Patreon at www.patreon.com/AOAwarfare to keep up to date on all my projects. Until next time, wear a mask, organize your community, and stay safe.